Remember, carrying a burdensome cross temporarily is not failure. If you have the real seed of success within you, a little adversity and temporary defeat will only serve to nurture that seed and cause it to birth forth into maturity. When divine intelligence wants a great man or woman to render some needed service in the world, the fortunate one is tested through some form of failure. If you are undergoing what you believe to be failure, have patience. You may be passing through your testing time. No capable executive would select as his lieutenant those whom he had not tested for reliability, loyalty, perseverance, and other essential qualities. Responsibility and all that goes with it in the way of remuneration always gravitates to the person who will not accept temporary defeat as a permanent failure. The test of a man is the fight he makes, the grit that he daily shows, the way he stands on his feet and takes fate's numerous bumps and blows. A coward can smile when there's naught to fear, when nothing his progress bars. But it takes a man to stand up and cheer while some other fellow stars. It isn't the victory, after all, but the fight that a brother makes. The man who, driven against the wall, still stands up erect and takes. The blows of fate with his head held high, bleeding and bruised and pale, is the man who'll win in the by and by, for he isn't afraid to fail. It's the bumps you get and the jolts you get, and the shocks that your courage stands. The hours of sorrow and vain regret, the prize that escapes your hands. That test your mettle and prove your worth, it isn't the blows you deal, but the blows you take on the good old earth that shows if your stuff is real. Failure often places one in a position where unusual effort must be forthcoming. Many a man has wrung victory from defeat, fighting with his back to the wall where he could not retreat. Caesar had long wished to conquer the British. He quietly sailed his soldier-laden ships to the British island, unloaded his troops and supplies, then gave the order to burn all the ships. Calling his soldiers about him, he said, "Now it is win or perish. We have no choice." They won. Men usually win when they make up their minds to do so. Burn your bridges behind you and observe how well you work when you know that you have no retreat. A streetcar conductor got a leave of absence while he tried out a position in the great mercantile business. "If I do not succeed in holding my new position," he remarked to a friend, "I can always come back to the old job." At the end of the month he was back, completely cured of all ambition to do anything except work on a streetcar. Had he resigned instead of asking for a leave of absence, he might have made good in a new job. The 13 Club movement, which is now spreading over the entire country, was born as the result of a shocking disappointment experienced by its founder. The shock was sufficient to open the mind to a broader and more comprehensive view of the needs of the age, and this discovery led to the creation of one of the most outstanding influences of this generation. The 15 Laws of Success, upon which this course is based, grew out of 25 years of hardship and poverty and failure, such as rarely come to one person in an entire lifetime. Surely those of you who have followed this series of lessons from the beginning must have read between the lines and back of them a story of struggle which has meant self-discipline and self-discovery, such as never would have been known without this hardship. Study the roadway of life in the picture at the beginning of the essay, and observe that everyone who travels that road carries a cross. Remember, as you take inventory of your own burdens, that nature's richest gift goes to those who meet failure without flinching or whining. Nature's ways are not easily understood. If they were, no one could be tested for greater responsibility with failure. Verse: when nature wants to make a man, and shake a man, and wake a man, when nature wants to make a man to do the future's will, when she tries with all her skill, and she yearns with all her soul, to create him large and whole, with what cunning she prepares him, how she goads and never spares him, how she whets him and she frets him, and in poverty begets him, how she often disappoints, how she often anoints, with what wisdom she will hide him, never minding what betide him, through his genius sob when slighting, and his pride may not forget, bids him struggle harder yet, makes him lonely, so that only God's high message shall reach him, so that she may surely teach him what the hierarchy planned. Though he may not understand, gives him passions to command, how remorselessly she spurs him, with terrific ardor stirs him, when she poignantly prefers him. Lo the crisis, lo the shout, that must call the leader out. When the people need salvation, doth he come to lead the nation. Then doth nature show her plan, when the world has found a man. There is no failure. That which looks to be failure is usually nothing but temporary defeat. Make sure that you do not accept it as permanent. End of lesson. The Law of Success, Lesson 12, Concentration. You can do it if you believe you can. This lesson occupies a keystone position in this course for the reason that the psychological law upon which it is based is of vital importance to every other lesson of this course. Let us first define the word concentration as it is here used as follows. Concentration is the act of focusing the mind upon a given desire until ways and means for its realization have been worked out and successfully put into operation. Two important laws enter into the act of concentrating the mind on a given desire. One is the law of autosuggestion, and the other is the law of habit. The former having been fully described in previous lessons on this course, we will now briefly describe the law of habit. Habit grows out of environment, out of doing the same thing in the same way over and over again, out of repetition, out of thinking the same thoughts over and over, and when once formed, it resembles a cement block that is hardened in the mold, in that it is hard to break. Habit is the basis of all memory training, a fact which you may easily demonstrate in remembering the name of a person whom you have just met, by repeating that name over and over until you have fixed it permanently and plainly in your mind. The force of education is so great that we may mold the minds and manners of the young into whatever shape we please and give the impressions of such habits as shall ever afterwards remain. Atterbury. Except on rare occasions when the mind rises above environment, the human mind draws the material out of which thought is created from the surrounding environment, and habit crystallizes this thought into a permanent fixture and stores it away in the subconscious mind, where it becomes a vital part of our personality, which silently influences our actions, forms our prejudices and our bias, and controls our opinions. A great philosopher had in mind the power of habit when he said, "We first endure, then pity, and finally embrace," in speaking of the manner in which honest men come to indulge in crime. Habit may be likened to the grooves of a phonograph record, while the mind may be likened to the needlepoint that fits into the grooves. When any habit has been well formed by repetition of thought or action, the mind attaches itself to and follows that habit as closely as the phonograph needle follows the groove in the wax record, no matter what may be the nature of that habit. We begin to see, therefore, the importance of selecting our environment with the greatest of care, because environment is the mental feeding ground out of which the food that goes into our mind is extracted. Environment very largely supplies the food and materials out of which we create thought, and habit crystallizes these into permanency. You, of course, understand that environment is the sum total of sources through which you are influenced by and through the aid of the five senses of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and feeling. Habit is force which is generally recognized by the average thinking person, but which is commonly viewed in its adverse aspect to the exclusion of its favorable phases. It has been well said that all men are the creatures of habit, and that habit is a cable. We weave a thread of it each day, and it becomes so strong that we cannot break it. If it be true that habit becomes a cruel tyrant, ruling and compelling men against their will, desire, and inclination, and this is true in many cases, the question naturally arises in the thinking mind whether this mighty force cannot be harnessed and controlled in the service of men, just have other forces of nature. If this result can be accomplished, then man may master habit and set it to work, instead of being a slave to it and serving it faithfully through complainings. And the modern psychologists tell us in no uncertain tones that habit may certainly be thus mastered, harnessed, and set to work, instead of being allowed to dominate one's actions and character. And thousands of people have applied this new knowledge and have turned the force of habit into new channels and have compelled it to work their machinery of action instead of being allowed to run to waste or else permitted to sweep away the structures that men have erected with care and expense or to destroy fertile mental fields. A habit is a mental path over which our actions have traveled for some time, each passing making the path a little deeper and a little wider. If you have to walk over a field or through a forest, you know how natural it is for you to choose the clearest path in preference to the less worn one, and greatly in preference to stepping out across the field or through the woods and making a new path. And the line of mental action is precisely the same. It is movement along the lines of least resistance, passage over the well-worn path. Habits are created by repetition and are formed in accordance to a natural law, observable in all animate things, and some would say in inanimate things as well. As an instance of the latter, it is pointed out that a piece of paper once folded in a certain way will fold along the same lines the next time. And all users of sewing machines or other delicate pieces of machinery know that as a machine or instrument is once broken in, so will it tend to run thereafter. The same law is also observable in the case of musical instruments. Clothing or clothes form into creases according to the person using them, and these creases, once formed, will always be in effect, notwithstanding repeated pressings. Rivers and streams of water cut their courses through the land, and thereafter flow along the habit course. The law is in operation everywhere. These illustrations will help you to form the idea of the nature of habit, and will aid you in forming new mental paths, new mental creases. And remember this always, the best, and one might say the only, way in which old habits may be removed is to form new habits to counteract and replace the undesirable ones. Form new mental paths over which to travel, and the old ones will soon become less distinct and in time will practically fill up from disuse. Every time you travel over the path of the desirable mental habit, you make the path deeper and wider and make it so much easier to travel thereafter. This mental path-making is a very important thing, and I cannot urge upon you too strongly the injunction to start to work making the desirable mental path over which you wish to travel. Practice, practice, practice. Be a good path-maker. The following are the rules of procedure through which you may form the habits you desire. First, at the beginning of the formation of a new habit, put force and enthusiasm into your expression. Feel what you think. Remember that you are taking the first steps towards making the new mental path, that it is much harder at first than it will be afterwards. Make the path as clear and as deep as you can at the beginning, so that you can readily see it the next time you wish to follow it. Second, keep your attention firmly concentrated on the new path building, and keep your mind away from the old path, lest you incline toward them. Forget all about the old path and concern yourself only with the new ones that you are building to order. Third, travel over your newly made paths as often as possible. Make opportunities for doing so without waiting for them to arise through luck or chance. The more often you go over the new path, the sooner will they become well-worn and easily traveled. Create plans for passing over these new habit paths at the very start. Fourth, resist the temptation to travel over the older, easier paths that you have been using in the past. Every time you resist a temptation, the stronger do you become, and the easier it'll be for you to do in the next time. But every time you yield to the temptation, the easier does it become to yield again, and the more difficult it becomes to resist the next time. You will have a fight at the start, and this is the critical time. Prove your determination, persistency, and willpower now, at the very beginning. Fifth, be sure that you have mapped out the right path as your definite chief aim, and then go ahead without fear and without allowing yourself to doubt. Place your hand upon the plow, and look not backward. Select your goal, then make good, deep, wide mental paths leading straight to it. As you've already observed, there is a close relationship between habit and auto-suggestion or self-suggestion. Through habit, an act repeatedly performed in the same manner has a tendency to become permanent, and eventually we come to perform the act automatically or unconsciously. In playing a piano, for example, the artist can play a familiar piece while his or her conscious mind is on some other subject. Auto-suggestion is a tool with which we dig a mental path. Concentration is the hand that holds that tool, and habit is the map or blueprint which the mental path follows. An idea or desire to be transformed into terms of action or physical reality must be held in the conscious mind faithfully and persistently until habit begins to give it permanent form. Let us turn our attention now to environment. As we have already seen, we absorb the material for thought from our surrounding environment. The term environment covers a very broad field. It consists of the books we read, the people with whom we associate, the community in which we live, the nature of our work in which we are engaged, the country or nation in which we reside, the clothes we wear, the songs we sing, and most importantly of all, the religious and intellectual training we receive prior to the age of 14 years. The purpose of analyzing the subject of environment is to show its direct relationship to the personality we are developing, and the importance of so guarding it that its influence will give us the materials out of which we may attain our definite chief aim in life. The mind feeds upon that which we supply it, or that which is forced upon it, through our environment. Therefore, let us select our environment as far as possible, with the object of supplying the mind with suitable material out of which to carry on its work of attaining our definite chief aim. If your environment is not to your liking, change it. The first step is to create in your own mind an exact, clear, and well-rounded out picture of the environment in which you believe you could best attain your definite chief aim. And then concentrate your mind upon this picture until you transform it into your reality. In Lesson 2 of this course, you learned that the first step you must take in the accomplishment of any desire is to create in your mind a dear, well-defined picture of that which you intend to accomplish. This is the first principle to be observed in your plans for the achievement of success, and if you fail or neglect to observe it, you cannot succeed except by chance. Your daily associates constitutes one of the most important and influential parts of your environment, and may work for your progress or your retrogression, according to the nature of these associates. As far as possible, you should select as your most intimate daily associates those who are in sympathy with your aims and ideals, especially those represented by your definite chief aim, and whose mental attitude inspires you with enthusiasm, self-confidence, determination, and ambition. Remember that every word spoken within your hearing, every sight that reaches your eyes, and every sense impression that you receive through any of the five senses influences your thought as surely as the sun rises in the east and sets in the west. This being true, can you not see the importance of controlling, as far as possible, the environment in which you live and work? Can you not see the importance of reading books that deal with subjects which are directly related to your definite chief aim? Can you not see the importance of talking with people who are in sympathy with your aims and who will encourage you and spur you on toward their attainment? We are living in what we call a 20th-century civilization. The leading scientists of the world are agreed that nature has been millions of years in creating, through the process of evolution, our present civilized environment. How many hundreds of centuries the so-called Indians have lived upon the North American continent without any appreciable advance towards modern civilization as we understand it, we have no way of ascertaining. Their environment was the wilderness, and they made no attempt whatsoever to change or improve that environment. The change took place only after new races from afar came over and forced upon them the environment of progressive civilization in which we are living today. Observe what has happened within the short period of 3 centuries. Hunting grounds have been transformed into great cities, and the Indian has taken on education and culture in many instances. that equal the accomplishment of his white brothers. In Lesson 15, we discuss the effects of environment from a worldwide viewpoint and describe in detail the principle of social heredity, which is the chief source through which the effects of environment may be imposed upon the minds of the young. The clothes you wear influence you. Therefore, they constitute a part of your environment. Soiled or shabby clothes depress you and lower your self-confidence, while clean clothes of an appropriate style have just the opposite effect. It is a well-known fact that an observant person can accurately analyze a man by seeing his workbench, desk, or other places of employment. A well-organized desk indicates a well-organized brain. Show me the merchant's stock of goods, and I will tell you whether he has an organized or disorganized brain, as there is a close relationship between one's mental attitude and one's physical environment. The effects of environment so vitally influence those who work in factories, stores, and offices that employers are gradually realizing the importance of creating an environment that inspires and encourages the workers. One unusually progressive laundryman in the city of Chicago has plainly outdone his competitors by installing in his workroom a player piano. In charge of a neatly dressed young woman who keeps it going during the working hours. His laundry women are dressed in white uniforms, and there is no evidence about the place that work is drudgery. Through the aid of this pleasant environment, this laundryman turns out more work, earns more profits, and pays better wages than his competitors can pay. This brings us to an appropriate place at which to describe the method through which you may apply the principles directly and indirectly related to the subject of concentration. Let us call this method the magic key to success. In presenting you with this magic key, let me first explain that it is no invention or discovery of mine. It is the same key that is used in one form or another by the followers of New Thought and all other sects which are founded upon the positive philosophy of optimism. This magic key constitutes an irresistible power which all who will may use. It will unlock the door to riches, it will unlock the door to fame, and in many instances it will unlock the door to physical health. It will unlock the door to education and let you into the storehouse of all your latent ability. It will act as a passkey to any position in life for which you are fitted. Through the aid of this magic key, we have unlocked the secret doors to all of the world's great inventions. Through its magic powers, all of our great geniuses of the past have been developed. Suppose you are a laborer in a menial position and desire a better place in life. The magic key will help you attain it. Through its use, Carnegie, Rockefeller, Hill, Harriman, Morgan, and scores of others of their type have accumulated vast fortunes of material wealth. It will unlock prison doors and turn human derelicts into useful, trustworthy human beings. It will turn failure into success and misery into happiness. You ask, what is this magic key? And I answer you with one word, concentration. Now let me define concentration in the sense that it is here used. First, I wish it to be clearly understood that I have no reference to occultism, although I will admit that all scientists of the world have failed to explain the strange phenomena produced through the aid of concentration. Concentration in the sense in which it is here used means the ability, through fixed habit and practice, to keep your mind on one subject until you have thoroughly familiarized yourself with that subject and mastered it. It means the ability to control your attention and focus it on a given problem until you have solved it. It means the ability to throw off the effects of habit which you wish to discard and the power to build new habits that are more to your liking. It means complete self-mastery. Stating it another way, concentration is the ability to think as you wish to think, the ability to control your thoughts and direct them to a definite end, and the ability to organize your knowledge into a plan of action that is sound and workable. You can readily see that in concentrating your mind upon your definite chief aim in life, you must cover many closely related subjects which blend into each other and complete the main subject upon which you are concentrating. Ambition and desire are the chief factors which enter into the act of successful concentration. Without these factors, the magic key is useless, And the main reason why so few people make use of this key is that most people lack ambition and desire nothing in particular. Desire whatever you may, and if your desire is within reason, and if it is strong enough, the magic key of concentration will help you to attain it. There are learned men of science who would have us believe that the wonderful power of prayer operates through the principle of concentration on the attainment of a deeply seated desire. Nothing was ever created by a human being without was not first created in imagination, through desire, and then transformed into reality through concentration. Now let us put the magic key to a test through the aid of a definite formula. First, you must put your foot on the neck of skepticism and doubt. No unbeliever ever enjoyed the benefits of this magic key. You must believe in the test that you are about to take. We will assume that you have thought something about becoming a successful writer, or a powerful public speaker, or a successful business executive, or an able financier. We will take public speaking as the subject of this test, but remember that you must follow instructions to the letter. Take a plain sheet of paper, ordinary letter size, and write on it the following. I am going to become a powerful public speaker, because this will enable me to render the world useful service that is needed, and because it will yield me a financial return that will provide me with the necessary material things of life. I will concentrate my mind upon this desire for 10 minutes daily, just before retiring at night and just after arising in the morning, for the purpose of determining just how I shall proceed to transform it into reality. I know that I can become a powerful and magnetic speaker. Therefore, I will permit nothing to interfere with my doing so. Sign this pledge. Then proceed to do as you have pledged your word that you would do. Keep it up until that desired result has been realized. Now, when you come to do your concentrating, this is the way to go about it. Look ahead 1, 2, 3, 5, or even 10 years, and see yourself as the most powerful speaker of your time. See in your imagination an appropriate income. See yourself in your own home that you have purchased with the proceeds from your efforts as a speaker or lecturer. See yourself in possession of a nice bank account as a reserve for old age. See yourself as a person of influence due to your great ability as a public speaker. See yourself engaged in a life calling in which you will not fear the loss of your position. Paint this picture clearly through the powers of your imagination, and lo, it will soon become transformed into a beautiful picture of deeply seated desire. Use this desire as the chief object of your concentration and observe what happens. You now have the secret of the magic key. Do not underestimate the power of the magic key because it did not come to you clothed in mysticism, or because it is described in a language which all who will may understand. All great truths are simple in final analysis and easily understood. If they are not, they are not great truths. Use this magic key with intelligence and only for the attainment of worthy ends, and it will bring you enduring happiness and success. Forget the mistakes you have made and the failures you have experienced. Quit living in the past, for do you not know that your yesterdays never return? Start all over again. If your previous efforts have not turned out well, and make the next 5 or 10 years tell a story of success that will satisfy your most lofty ambitions. Make a name for yourself and render the world a great service through ambition, desire, and concentrated effort. You can do it if you believe you can. Thus endeth the magic key. The presence of any idea or thought in your consciousness tends to produce an associated feeling and to urge you to appropriate or corresponding action. Hold a deeply seated desire in your consciousness through the principle of concentration, and if you do it with full faith in its realization, your act attracts to your aid powers which the entire scientific world has failed to understand or explain with a reasonable hypothesis. When you become familiar with the powers of concentration, you will then understand the reason for choosing a definite chief aim as the first step in the attainment of enduring success. Concentrate your mind upon the attainment of the object of a deeply seated desire, and very soon you will become a lodestone that attracts, through the aid of forces which no man can explain, the necessary material counterparts of that desire. A statement of fact which paves the way for the description of a principle which constitutes the most important part of this lesson, if not, in fact, the most important part of the entire course. When two or more people ally themselves in a spirit of perfect harmony for the purpose of attaining a definite end, if that alliance is faithfully observed by all of whom it is composed, the alliance brings to each of those of whom it is composed power that is superhuman and seemingly irresistible in nature. Back of the foregoing statement is a law, the nature of which science has not yet determined, and it is this law that I have had in mind in connection with my repeated statements concerning the power of organized effort, which you will notice throughout this course. In chemistry, we learn that two or more elements may be so compounded that the result is something entirely different in nature from any of the individual elements. For example, ordinary water, known in chemistry under the formula of H2O, is a compound consisting of two atoms of hydrogen and one atom of oxygen. But water is neither hydrogen nor oxygen. The marrying of elements created an entirely different substance from that of either of its component parts. The same laws through which this transformation of physical elements takes place may be responsible for the seemingly superhuman powers resulting from the alliance of two or more people in a perfect state of harmony and understanding for the attainment of a given end. This world and all matter of which the other planets consist is made up of electrons, an electron being the smallest known analyzable unit of matter and resembling in nature what we call electricity or a form of energy. On the other hand, thought and that which we call the mind is also a form of energy. In fact, it is the highest form of energy known. Thought, in other words, is organized energy, and it is not improbable that thought is exactly the same sort of energy as that which we generate with an electric dynamo, although of a much more highly organized form. Now, if all matter, in final analysis, consists of groups of electrons, which are nothing more than a form of energy which we call electricity, and if the mind is nothing but a form of highly organized electricity, do you not see how it is possible that the laws which affect matter may also govern the mind? And if combining two or more elements of matter in the proper proportion and under the right conditions will produce something entirely different from those original elements, as in the case of H2O, do you not see how it is possible so to combine the energy of two or more minds that the result will be a sort of composite mind that is totally different from the individual minds of which it consists? You have undoubtedly noticed the manner in which you are influenced while in the presence of other people. Some people inspire you with optimism and enthusiasm. Their very presence seems to stimulate your own mind to greater action. And this not only seems to be true, but it is true. You have noticed that the presence of others had a tendency to lower your vitality and depress you, a tendency which I can assure you is very real. What do you imagine could be the cause of these changes that come over us when we come within a certain range of other people, unless it is the change resulting from the blending or combining of their minds with our own, through the operation of a law that is not very well understood, but resembles, if in fact it is not the same law, the law through which the combining of two atoms of hydrogen and one atom of oxygen produces water? I have no scientific basis for this hypothesis, but I have given it many years of serious thought, and always I come to the conclusion that it is at least a second hypothesis, although I have no possible way as yet of reducing it to a provable hypothesis. You need no proof, however, that the presence of some people inspire you, while the presence of others depress you, as you know this to be a fact. Now it stands to reason that the person who inspires you and arouses your mind to a state of greater activity gives you more power to achieve, while the person who's present depresses you and lowers your vitality, or causes you to dissipate in useless, disorganized thought, has just the opposite effect on you. You can understand this much without the aid of an hypothesis and without further proof than that which you have experienced time after time. Come back now to the original statement that when two or more people ally themselves in a spirit of perfect harmony for the purpose of attaining a definite end, if that alliance is faithfully observed by all whom it is composed, the alliance brings to each of those of whom it is composed power that is superhuman and seemingly irresistible in nature. Study closely the emphasized part of the foregoing statement, for there you will find the mental formula which, if not faithfully observed, destroys the effect of the whole. One atom of hydrogen combined with one atom of oxygen will not produce water, nor will an alliance in name only, that is not accompanied by a spirit of perfect harmony between these forming the alliance, produce power that is superhuman and seemingly irresistible in nature. I have in mind a family of mountain folk who for more than six generations have lived in the mountainous section of Kentucky. Generation after generation of this family came and went without any noticeable improvement of a mental nature. Each generation following in the footsteps of its ancestors, they made their living from the soil, and as far as they knew or cared, the universe consisted of a little spot of territory known as Letcher County. They married strictly in their own set and in their own community. Finally, one of the members of this family strayed away from the flock, so to speak, and married a well-educated and highly cultured woman from the neighbor state of Virginia. This woman was one of those types of ambitious people who had learned that the universe extended beyond the borderline of Letcher County and covered at least the whole of the southern state. She had heard of chemistry and of botany and of biology and of pathology and of psychology and of many other subjects that were of importance in the field of education. When her children began to come along to the age of understanding, she talked to them of these subjects, and they in turn began to show a keen interest in them. One of her children is now the president of a great educational institution where most of these subjects and many others of equal importance are taught. Another one of them is a prominent lawyer, while still another is a successful physician. Her husband, thanks to the influence of her mind, is a well-known dental surgeon and the first of his family for six generations to break away from the traditions by which the family had been bound. The blending of her mind with his gave him the needed stimulus to spur him on and inspired him with ambition such as he would never have known without her influence. For many years, I have been studying the biographies of those whom the world calls great, and it seems to me more than a mere coincidence that in every instance where the facts were available, the person who was really responsible for the greatness was in the background, behind the scenes, and seldom heard of by the hero-worshipping public. Not infrequently, is this hidden power a patient little wife who has inspired her husband and urged him on to great achievement, as was true in the case I have just described. Henry Ford is one of the modern miracles of this age, and I doubt that his country or any other ever produced an industrial genius of his equal. If the facts were known, and perhaps they are known, they might trace the cause of Mr. Ford's phenomenal achievements to a woman of whom the public hears but little. His wife. We read of Ford's achievements and of his enormous income and imaging him to be blessed with matchless ability, and he is, ability of which the world would never have heard about had it not been for the modifying influences of his wife, who has cooperated with him during all the years of his struggle in a spirit of perfect harmony for the purpose of attaining a definite end. I have in mind another genius who is well known to the entire civilized world, Thomas Edison. His inventions are so well known that they need not be named. Every time you press a button and turn on an electric light, or hear a phonograph playing, you should think of Edison, for it was he who perfected both the incandescent light and the modern phonograph. Every time you see a moving picture, you should think of Edison, for it was his genius, more than that of any other person who made this great enterprise possible. But as in the case of Henry Ford, back of Mr. Edison stands one of the most remarkable women in America, his wife. No one outside of the Edison family and perhaps a very few intimate personal friends of theirs, knows to what extent her influence has made Edison's achievements possible. Mrs. Edison once told me that Mr. Edison's outstanding quality, the one which, above all others, was his greatest asset, was that of concentration. When Mr. Edison starts a line of experiment or research or investigation, he never lets go until he either finds that for which he is looking or exhausts every possible effort to do so. Back of Mr. Edison stand two great powers. One is concentration, and the other is Mrs. Edison. Night after night, Mr. Edison has worked with such enthusiasm that he required but 3 or 4 hours of sleep. Observe what was said about the sustaining effects of enthusiasm in Lesson 7 of this course. Plant a tiny apple seed in the right sort of soil at the right time of year, and gradually it will burst forth into a teeny sprig, and then it will expand and grow into an apple tree. That tree does not come from the soil, nor does it come from the elements of the air, but from both of these sources. And the man has not yet lived who could explain the law that attracts from the air and the soil the combination of cells of which that apple tree consists. The tree does not come out of the teeny apple seed, but that seed is the beginning of the tree. When two or more people ally themselves in a spirit of perfect harmony for the purpose of attaining a definite end, the end itself or the desire back of that end may be likened to the apple seed, and the blending of the forces of energy of the two or more minds may be likened to the air and the soil out of which come the elements that form the material objects of that desire. The power back of the attraction and combination of these forces of the mind can no more be explained than can the power back of the combination of the elements out of which an apple tree grows. But the all-important thing is that an apple tree will grow from a seed thus properly planted. A great achievement will follow the systematic blending of two or more minds with a definite object in view. In Lesson 13, you will see this principle of allied effort carried to proportions which almost stagger the imagination of all who have not trained themselves to think in terms of organized thought. This course itself is a very concrete illustration of the principle underlying that which we have termed organized effort. But you will observe that it requires the entire 16 lessons to complete the description of this principle. Omit a single one of the 16 lessons, and the omission would affect the whole, as the removal of one link would affect the whole of a chain. As I have already stated in many different ways, and for the purpose of emphasis, I now repeat, there is a well-founded hypothesis that when one concentrates one mind upon a given subject, facts of a nature that is closely related to that subject will pour in from every conceivable source. The theory is that a deeply seated desire, when once planted in the right sort of mental soil, serves as a center of attraction or magnet that attracts to it everything that harmonizes with the nature of that desire. Dr. Elmer Gates of Washington, D.C. is perhaps one of the most competent psychologists in the world. He is recognized both in the field of psychology and in other directly and indirectly related fields of science throughout the world as being a man of the highest scientific standing. Come with me for a moment and study his methods. After Dr. Gates has followed a line of investigation as far as possible through the usual channels of research and has availed himself of all the recorded facts at his command on a given subject, he then takes a pencil and a tablet and sits for further information. By concentrating his mind on that subject until thoughts related to it begin to flow in upon him, he writes down these thoughts as they come from he knows not where. He told me that many of his most important discoveries came through this method. It is more than 20 years ago that I first talked with Dr. Gates on this subject. Since that time, through the discovery of the radio principle, we have been provided with a reasonable hypothesis through which to explain the results of these sittings. The ether, as we have discovered through the modern radio apparatus, is in a constant state of agitation. Sound waves are floating through the ether at all times, but these waves cannot be detected beyond a short distance from their source, except by the aid of properly tuned instruments. Now it seems reasonable to suppose that thought, being the most highly organized form of energy known, is constantly sending waves through the ether, but these waves, like those of sounds, can only be detected and correctly interpreted by a properly attuned mind. There is no doubt that when Dr. Gates sat down in a room and placed himself in a quiet, passive state of mind, the dominating thoughts in his mind served as a magnetic force that attracted the related or similar thought waves of others as they passed through the ether about him. Taking the hypothesis just a step further, it has occurred to me many times since the discovery of the modern radio principle that every thought that has ever been released in organized form from the mind of any human being is still in existence in the form of a wave in the ether and is constantly passing around and around in a great endless circle. That the act of concentrating one mind upon a given subject with intensity sends out thought waves which reach and blend with those of a related or similar nature, thereby establishing a direct line of communication between the one doing the concentrating and the thoughts of a similar nature which had been previously set into motion. Going still a step further, may it not be possible for one so to attune his mind and harmonize the rate of vibration of thought with the rate of vibration of the ether, that all knowledge that has been accumulated through the organized thoughts of the past is available? With this hypothesis in mind, go back to Lesson 2 of this course and study Carnegie's description of the mastermind, through which he accumulated his great fortune. When Carnegie formed an alliance between more than a score of carefully selected minds, he created, by that means of compounding mind power, one of the strongest industrial forces that the world has ever witnessed, with a few notable and very disastrous exceptions. The men constituting the mastermind which Carnegie created thought and acted as one. And that mastermind, composed of many individual minds, was concentrated upon a single purpose, the nature of which is familiar to everyone who knew Mr. Carnegie's, particularly those who were competing with him in the steel business. If you have followed Henry Ford's record, even slightly, you undoubtedly have observed that concentrated effort has been one of the outstanding features of his career. Nearly 30 years ago, he adopted a policy of standardization as to the general type of automobile that he would build. And he consistently maintained that policy until the change in public demand forced him in 1927 to change it. A few years ago, I met the former chief engineer of the Ford plant, and he told me of an incident that happened during the early stages of Mr. Ford's automobile experience, which very clearly points to concentrated effort as being one of his prominent fundamentals of economic philosophy. On this occasion, the engineers of the Ford plant had gathered in the engineering office for the purpose of discussing a proposed change in the design of the rear axle construction of the Ford automobile. Mr. Ford stood around and listened to the discussion until each man had had his say, and he walked over to the table, tapped the drawing on the proposed axle with his finger, and said, "Now listen, the axle we are using does the work for which it was intended, and it does it well, and there is going to be no more change in that axle." He turned and walked away, and from that day until this, the rear axle construction of the Ford automobile has remained substantially the same. It is not improbable that Mr. Ford's success in building and marketing automobiles has been due very largely to his policy of consistently concentrating his efforts back of one plan, with but one definite purpose in mind at a time. A few years ago, I read Edwin Bach's book, The Man from Maine, which is the biography of his father-in-law, Mr. Cyrus H.K. Curtis, the owner of the Saturday Night Evening Post, the Ladies' Home Journal, and several other publications. All through the book, I noticed that the outstanding feature of Mr. Curtis's philosophy was that of concentration of effort back of a definite purpose. During the early days of his ownership of the Saturday Night Evening Post, when he was pouring money into a losing venture by the hundreds of thousands of dollars, it required concentrated effort that was backed by courage such as but few men possess to enable him to carry on. Read The Man from Maine. It is a splendid lesson on the subject of concentration and supports to the smallest detail the fundamentals upon which this lesson is based. The Saturday Evening Post is now one of the most profitable magazines in the world, but its name would have been long since forgotten had not Mr. Curtis concentrated his attention and his fortune on the one definite purpose of making it a great magazine. We have seen what an important part environment and habit play in connection with the subject of concentration. We shall now discuss briefly a third subject which is no less related to the subject of concentration than are the other two, namely memory. The principles through which an accurate, unfaltering memory may be trained are few and comparatively simple. First, retention, the receiving of the sense impression through one or more of the five senses, and the recording of this impression in orderly fashion in the mind. This process may be likened to the recording of a picture on the sensitive plate of a camera or Kodak. 2. Recall, the reviving or recalling into the conscious mind of those sense impressions which have been recorded in the subconscious mind. This process may be compared to the act of going through a card index and pulling out a card on which information had been previously recorded. 3. Recognition, the ability to recognize a sense impression when it is called into the conscious mind, and to identify it as being a duplicate of the original impression, and to associate it with the original score from which it came when it was first recorded. This process enables us to distinguish between memory and imagination. These are the three principles that enter into the act of remembering. Now let us make application of these principles and determine how to use them effectively, which may be done as follows. First, when you wish to be sure of your ability to recall a sense impression, such as a name, date, or place, be sure to make the impression vivid by concentrating your attention upon it to the finest detail. An effective way to do this is to repeat several times that which you wish to remember. Just as a photographer must give an exposure proper time to record itself on the sensitized plate of the camera, so must we give the subconscious mind time to record properly and clearly any sense impressions that we wish to be able to recall with readiness. Second, associate that which you wish to remember with some other object, name, place, or date, with which you are quite familiar, and which you can easily recall when you wish, as for example, the name of your hometown, your close friend, the date of your birth, etc., for your mind will then file away the sense impression that you wish to be able to recall with the one that you can easily recall, so that when bringing forth one into the conscious mind, it brings also the other one with it. Thirdly, repeat that which you wish to remember a number of times, at the same time concentrating your mind upon it, just as you would fix your mind on a certain hour at which you wish to arise in the morning, which, as you know, ensures your awakening at that precise hour. The common failings of not being able to remember the names of other people, which most of us have, is due entirely to the first fact that we do not properly record the name in the first place. When you are introduced to a person whose name you wish to be able to recall at will, repeat that name four or five times, first making sure that you understand the name correctly. If the name is similar to that of some person whom you know well, associate the two names together, thinking of both as you repeat the name of the one whose name you wish to be able to recall. If someone gives you a letter to be mailed, look at the letter, then increase its size in your imagination, and see it hanging over a letterbox. Fix in your mind a letter approximately the size of a door, and associate it with a letterbox, and you will observe that the first letterbox you pass on the street will cause you to recall that big, odd-looking letter which you have in your pocket. Suppose you were introduced to a lady whose name was Elizabeth Shear, and you wish to be able to recall her name at will. As you repeat her name, associate it with a large pair of scissors, say 10 feet in length, and Queen Elizabeth, and you will observe that the recalling of either the large pair of scissors or the name of Queen Elizabeth will help you recall also the name of Elizabeth Shear. If you wish to be able to remember the name of Lloyd Keith, just repeat the name several times and associate with the name of Lloyd George and Keith's Theater, either of which you can easily recall at will. The law of association is the most important feature of a well-trained memory, yet it is a very simple law. All you have to do to make use of it is to record the name of that which you wish to remember, with the name of that which you can readily remember, and the recalling of one brings with it the other. Nearly 10 years ago, a friend of mine gave me his resident telephone number in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and although I did not write it down, I remember it today as well as I did the day he gave it to me, and this is the way that I recorded it. The number and exchange were Lakeview 2651. At the time he gave me the number, we were standing at the railroad station in sight of Lake Michigan. Therefore, I used the lake and an associated object with which to file the name of the telephone exchange. It so happened that the brother number was made up of the age of my brother, who was 26, and my father, who was 51. Therefore, I associated their names with a number, thus ensuring its recall. To recall the number and exchange, therefore, I only had to think of Lake Michigan, my brother and my father. An acquaintance of mine found himself to be suffering from what is ordinarily called a wandering mind. He was becoming absent-minded and unable to remember. Let him tell you in his own words, which follows, how he overcame this handicap. I am 50 years old. For a decade, I have been a department manager in a large factory. At first, my duties were easy. Then the firm had a rapid expansion of business, which gave me added responsibilities. Several of the young men in my department developed unusual energy and ability. At least one of them had his eyes on my job. I had reached the age in life when a man likes to be comfortable, and having been with the company a long time, I felt that I could safely settle back into an easy berth. The effect of this mental attitude was well nigh disastrous to my position. About 2 years ago, I noticed that my power of concentration was weakening, and my duties were becoming irksome. I neglected my correspondence until I looked with dread upon the formidable pile of letters. Reports accumulated, and subordinates were inconvenienced by the delay. I sat at my desk with my mind wandering elsewhere. Other circumstances showed plainly that my mind was not on my work. I forgot to attend an important meeting of the officers of the company. One of the clerks under me caught a bad mistake made in an estimate on a carload of goods, and of course saw to it that the manager learned of the incident. I was thoroughly alarmed at the situation and asked for a week's vacation to think things over. I was determined to resign or find the trouble and remedy it. A few days of earnest introspection at an out-of-the-way mountain resort convinced me that I was suffering from a plain case of mind wandering. I was lacking in concentration. My physical and mental activities at the desk had become regrettable. I was careless and shiftless and neglectful, all because my mind was not alertly on my job. When I had diagnosed my case with satisfaction to myself, I next sought the remedy. I needed a complete new set of working habits, and I made a resolve to acquire them. With paper and pencil, I outlined a schedule to cover the working day. First, the morning mail. Then the orders to be filled, dictation, conference with subordinates and miscellaneous duties, ending with a clean desk before I left. How is habit formed? I asked myself mentally. By repetition, came back the answer. But I have been doing these things over and over, thousands of times, the other fellow in me protested. True, but not in orderly, concentrated fashion, replied the echo. I returned to the office with mind in leash, but restless, and placed my new working schedule in force at once. I performed the same duties with the same zest, and as nearly as possible at the same time every day. When my mind started to slip away, I quickly brought it back. From a mental stimulus created by willpower, I progressed in habit building. Day after day, I practiced concentration of thought. When I found repetition becoming comfortable, then I knew that I'd won. Your ability to train your memory or to develop any desired habit is a matter solely of being able to fix your attention on a given subject until the outline of that subject has been thoroughly impressed upon the sensitized plate of your mind. Concentration itself is nothing but a matter of control of the attention. You will observe that by reading a line of print with which you are not familiar and which you have never seen before, and then closing your eyes, you can see that line as plainly as though you were looking at it on a printed page. In reality, you are looking at it, not on a printed page, but on the sensitized plate of your own mind. If you try this experiment and it does not work the first time, it is because you did not concentrate your attention on the line closely enough. Repeat the performance a few times, and finally you will succeed. If you wish to memorize poetry, for example, you can do so very quickly by training yourself to fix your attention on the lines so closely that you can shut your eyes and see them in your mind as plainly as you can see them on a printed paper. So important is this subject of control of intention that I feel impelled to emphasize it in such a way that you will not pass it by lightly. I have reserved reference to this important subject until the last, as a climax to this lesson, for the reason that I consider it by far the most important part of the lesson. The astounding results experienced by those who make a practice of crystal gazing are due entirely to their ability to fix attention upon a given subject for the unbroken period far beyond the ordinary. Crystal gazing is nothing but concentrated attention. I have already hinted at that which I will now state as my belief, namely that it is possible through the aid of concentrated attention for one so to attune one's mind to the vibration of the ether that all the secrets in the world of unfathomed and uncharted mental phenomena may become as open books which may be read at will. What a thought this is to ponder! I am of the opinion, and not without substantial evidence to support me, that it is possible for one to develop the ability of fixing the attention so highly that one may tune in and understand that which is in the mind of any person. But this is not all, nor is it the most important part of a hypothesis at which I have arrived after many years of careful research. For I am satisfied that one may just as easily go a step further and tune in on the universal mind, in which all knowledge is stored, where it may be appropriated by all who master the art of coming after it. To a highly orthodox mind, these statements may seem very irrational, but to the student, and so far there are but a few people in the world who are more than mere students of an elementary grade of this subject, who has studied this subject with any appreciable degree of understanding, these hypotheses seem not only possible, but absolutely probable. But put the hypothesis to a test of your own. You can select no better subject upon which to try an experiment than that which you have selected as your definite chief aim in life. Memorize your definite chief aim so you can repeat it without looking at the written page. Then make a practice of fixing your attention on it at least twice a day, proceeding as follows. Go into some quiet place where you will not be disturbed. Sit down and completely relax your mind and your body. Then close your eyes and place your fingers in your ears, thereby excluding the ordinary sound waves and all of the light waves. In that position, repeat your definite chief aim in life. And as you do so, see yourself and your imagination in full possession of the object of that aim. If a part of your aim is the accumulation of money, as it undoubtedly is, then see yourself in possession of that money. If a part of the object of your definite aim is the ownership of a home, then see a picture of that home in your imagination, just as you expect to see it in reality. If a part of your definite aim is to become a powerful and influential public speaker, then see yourself before an enormous audience, and feel yourself playing upon the emotions of that audience as a great violinist would play upon the strings of a violin. As you approach the end of this lesson, there are two things which you might do. First, you might begin now to cultivate the ability to fix attention at will on a given subject, with a feeling that this ability, when fully developed, would bring you the object of your definite chief aim in life. Or, secondly, you might tilt your nose in the air and with the smile of a cynic say to yourself, "Bosh," and thereby mark yourself a fool. Take your choice. This lesson was not written as an argument, nor as the subject of a debate. It is your privilege to accept it in whole or in part, or reject it, just as you please. But at this place I wish to state, however, that this is not an age of cynicism or doubt, an age that has conquered the air above us and the sea beneath us, that has enabled us to harness the air and turn it into a messenger that will carry the sound of your voice halfway around the earth. in the fractional part of a second certainly is not an age that lends encouragement to the doubting Thomases or the I don't believe it Joneses. The human family has passed through the Stone Age and the Iron Age and the Steel Age, and unless I have greatly misinterpreted the trend of time, it is now entering the Mind Power Age, which will eclipse in stupendous